We make this point to parents all the time. It was especially effective with one single father who visited Tina in her office. He was at his wit's end because his 5-year-old clearly demonstrated the ability to act appropriately and make good decisions. But at times, his son would melt down over the smallest thing. Here's how Tina approached the conversation.
I began by trying to explain to this dad that at times his son couldn't regulate himself, which meant that he wasn't choosing to be willful or defiant. The father's body language in response to my explanation was clear. He crossed his arms and leaned back in his chair. Although he didn't literally roll his eyes, it was clear he wasn't about to start a Tina Bryson fan club. So I said, "I'm getting the sense you don't agree with me here." He responded, "It just doesn't make sense. Sometimes he's great about handling even big disappointments, like last week when he didn't get to go to the hockey game. Then other times he'll completely lose his mind because he can't have the blue cup because it's in the dishwasher. It's not about what he can't do. He's just spoiled and needs stricter discipline. He needs to learn how to obey. And he can. He's already proven he can totally choose how to handle himself." I decided to take a therapeutic risk, doing something out of the ordinary without knowing quite how it would go. I nodded, then asked, "I bet you're a loving and patient dad most of the time, right?" He replied, "Yes, most of the time. Sometimes, of course, I'm not." I tried to communicate some humor and playfulness in my tone as I said, "So you can be patient and loving, but sometimes you're choosing not to be." Fortunately, he smiled, beginning to see where I was going, so I pressed on. "If you loved your son, wouldn't you make better choices and be a good dad all of the time? Why are you choosing to be impatient or reactive?" He began to nod and broke out in an even bigger smile, acknowledging my playfulness as the point sank in. I continued, "What is it that makes it hard to be patient?" He said, "Well, it depends on how I'm feeling, like if I'm tired or I've had a rough day at work or something." I smiled and said, "You know where I'm going with this, don't you?"
Of course he did. Tina went on to explain that a person's capacity to handle situations well and make good decisions can really fluctuate according to the circumstances and the context of a given situation. Simply because we're human, our capacity to handle ourselves well is not stable and constant. And that's certainly the case with a 5-year-old. The father clearly understood what Tina was saying, that it's misguided to assume that just because his son could handle himself well in one moment, he'd always be able to do so. And that when his son didn't manage his feelings and behaviors, it wasn't evidence that he was spoiled and needed stricter discipline. Rather, he needed understanding and help. And through emotional connection and setting limits, the father could increase and expand his son's capacity. The truth is that for all of us, our capacity fluctuates given our state of mind and state of body. And these states are influenced by so many factors, especially in the case of a developing brain in a developing child. Tina and the father talked further, and it was clear that he had fully understood Tina's point. He got the difference between can't and won't, and he saw that he was imposing rigid and developmentally inappropriate one-size-fits-all expectations on his young son, as well as on the boy's sister. This new perspective empowered him to switch off his parental autopilot and start working on making intentional, moment-by-moment decisions with his children, both of whom had their own particular personality and needs at different moments. The father realized that not only could he still set clear, firm boundaries, but he could do so even more effectively and respectfully because he was taking into account each child's individual temperament and fluctuating capacity along with the context of each situation. As a result, he'd be able to achieve both disciplinary goals, to see less overall uncooperative behavior from his son, and to teach him important skills and life lessons that would help him as he grew into a man. This father was learning to challenge certain assumptions in his own thinking, such as that misbehavior is always willful opposition instead of a moment of difficulty while trying to manage feelings and behavior. Future conversations with Tina led him to question not only this assumption, but also his emphasis on having his son and daughter obey him unconditionally and without exception. Yes, he reasonably and justifiably wanted his discipline to encourage cooperation from his children. But complete and unquestioning obedience, did he want his kids to grow up blindly obeying everyone their whole lives? Or would he rather have them develop their own individual personalities and identities, learning along the way what it means to get along with others, observe limits, make good decisions, be self-disciplined, and navigate difficult situations by thinking for themselves? Again, he got the point, and it made all the difference for his children. One other assumption this father began to challenge within himself was that there's some silver bullet or magic wand that can be used to address any behavioral issue or concern. We wish there was such a cure-all, but there's not. It's tempting to buy into one discipline practice that promises to work all the time and in every situation, or to radically change a kid in a few days. But the dynamics of interacting with children are always much more complex than that. Behavioral issues simply can't be resolved with a one-size-fits-all approach that we apply to every circumstance or environment or child. Let's take a few minutes now and discuss the two most common one-size-fits-all disciplinary techniques that parents rely on, spanking and timeouts. Spanking and the brain. One autopilot response that a number of parents resort to is spanking. We often get asked where we stand on the subject. Although we're really big advocates for boundaries and limits, we are both strongly against spanking. Physical punishment is a complex and highly charged topic, and a full discussion of the research, the various contexts in which physical punishment takes place, and the negative impacts of spanking is beyond the scope of this book. But based on our neuroscientific perspective and review of the research literature, we believe that spanking is likely to be counterproductive when it comes to building respectful relationships with our children, teaching kids the lessons we want them to learn, and encouraging optimal development. We also believe that children should have the right to be free from any form of violence, especially at the hands of the people they trust most to protect them. We know there are all kinds of parents, all kinds of kids, and all kinds of contexts in which discipline takes place. And we certainly understand that frustration, along with the desire to do the right thing for their children, leads some parents to use spanking as a discipline strategy. But the research consistently demonstrates that even when parents are warm, loving, and nurturing, not only is spanking children less effective in changing behavior in the long run, it's associated with negative outcomes in many domains. Granted, there are plenty of non-spanking discipline approaches that can be just as damaging as spanking. Isolating children for long periods of time, humiliating them, terrifying them by screaming threats, and using other forms of verbal or psychological aggression are all examples of disciplinary practices that wound children's minds even when their parents never physically touch them. We therefore encourage parents to avoid any discipline approach that is aggressive, inflicts pain, or creates fear or terror. For one thing, it's counterproductive. The child's attention shifts from her own behavior and how to modify it to the caregiver's response to the behavior, meaning that the child no longer considers her own actions at all. Instead, She thinks only about how unfair and mean her parent was to hurt her, or even how scary her parent was in that moment. The parental response, then, undermines both of the primary goals of discipline, changing behavior and building the brain, because it sidesteps an opportunity for the child to think about her own behavior and even feel some healthy guilt or remorse. Another important problem with spanking is what happens to the child physiologically and neurologically. The brain interprets pain as a threat. So when a parent inflicts physical pain on a child, that child faces an unsolvable biological paradox. On one hand, we are all born with an instinct to go toward our caregivers for protection when we're hurt or afraid. But when our caregivers are also the source of the pain and fear, when the parent has caused the state of terror inside the child by what he or she has done, it can be very confusing for the child's brain. One circuit drives the child to try to escape the parent who is inflicting pain. Another circuit drives the child toward the attachment figure for safety. So when the parent is the source of fear or pain, the brain can become disorganized in its functioning, as there is no solution. We call this, at the extreme, a form of disorganized attachment. The stress hormone cortisol, released with such a disorganized internal state and repeated interpersonal experiences of rage and terror, can lead to long-lasting negative impacts on the brain's development, as cortisol is toxic to the brain and inhibits healthy growth. Harsh and severe punishment can actually lead to significant changes in the brain, such as the death of brain connections and even brain cells. Another problem with spanking is that it teaches the child that the parent has no effective strategy short of inflicting bodily pain. That's a direct lesson every parent should consider quite deeply. Do we want to teach our kids that the way to resolve a conflict is to inflict physical pain, particularly on someone who is defenseless and cannot fight back? Looking through the lens of the brain and body, we know that humans are instinctually wired to avoid pain, and it is also the same part of the brain that mediates physical pain, that processes social rejection. Inflicting physical pain is also creating social rejection in the child's brain. Since children can't be perfect, we see the importance of the findings indicating that while spanking often stops a behavior in a particular moment, it's not as effective at changing behavior in the long run. Instead, children will often just get better at concealing what they've done. In other words, the danger is that kids will do whatever it takes to avoid the pain of physical punishment and social rejection, which will often mean more lying and hiding, not collaboratively communicating and being open to learning. One final point about spanking has to do with which part of the brain we want to appeal to and develop with our discipline. As we'll explain in the next chapter, parents have the option of engaging the higher, thinking part of the child's wise brain or the lower, more reactive, reptilian part. If you threaten or physically attack a reptile, what kind of response do you think you'll get? Imagine a cornered cobra spitting at you. There is nothing wise or connecting about being reactive. When we are threatened or physically attacked, our reptilian or primitive brain takes over. We move into an adaptive survival mode, often called fight, flight, or freeze. We can also faint, a response that occurs in some when they feel totally helpless. Likewise, when we cause our kids to experience fear, pain, and anger, we activate an increase in the flow of energy and information to the primitive, reactive brain instead of directing the flow to the receptive, thinking, more sophisticated, and potentially wise regions of the brain that allow kids to make healthy and flexible choices and handle their emotions well. Do you want to trigger reactivity in your child's primitive brain or engage her thinking, rational brain in being receptive and openly engaged with the world? When we activate the reactive states of the brain, we miss the chance to develop the thinking part of the brain. It's a lost opportunity. What's more, we have so many other, more effective options for disciplining our kids. Strategies that give children practice using their upstairs brain so that it's stronger and further developed. Meaning that they're much better able to be responsible people who do the right thing more often than not. Much more about that in chapters 3 through 6. What about timeouts? Aren't they an effective discipline tool? These days, most parents who have decided they don't want to spank their kids assume that timeouts are the best available option. But are they? Do they help us achieve our discipline goals? In general terms, we don't think so. We know lots of loving parents who use timeouts as their primary discipline technique. But after exploring the research, talking to thousands of parents, and raising our own kids, we've come up with several main reasons we do not think that timeouts are the best discipline strategy. For one thing, when parents use timeouts, they often use them a lot and out of anger. But parents can give children more positive and meaningful experiences that better achieve our dual goals of encouraging cooperation and building the brain. As we'll explain in more detail in the next chapter, brain connections are formed from repeated experiences. And what experience does a timeout give a child? Isolation. Even if you can offer a timeout in a loving manner, do you want your child's repeated experiences when she makes a mistake to be time by herself, which is often experienced, particularly by young children, as rejection? Wouldn't it be better to have her experience what it means to do things the right way? So instead of a timeout, you might ask her to practice handling a situation differently. If she's being disrespectful in her tone or words, you can have her try it again and communicate what she's saying respectfully. If she's been mean to her brother, you might ask her to find 3 kind things to do for him before bedtime. That way, the repeated experience of positive behavior begins to get wired into her brain. Again, we'll cover this in more depth in the following chapters. In short, timeouts often fail to accomplish their objective, which is supposed to be for our children to calm down and reflect on their behavior. In our experience, timeouts frequently just make children angrier and more dysregulated, leaving them even less able to control themselves or think about what they've done. Plus, how often do you think kids use their timeouts to reflect on their behavior? We've got news for you. The main thing kids reflect on while in timeout is how mean their parents are to have put them there. When children are reflecting on their horrible luck to have such a mean, unfair mom or dad, they're missing out on an opportunity to build insight, empathy, and problem-solving skills. Putting them in timeout deprives them of a chance to practice being active, empathic decision-makers who are empowered to figure things out. We want to give them opportunities to be problem solvers, to make good choices, and to be comforted when they are falling apart. You can do your kids a lot of good simply by asking, "What are some ideas you have to make it better and solve the problem?" Given the chance once they're calm, kids will usually do the right thing and learn in the process. In addition, too often timeouts aren't directly and logically linked to a particular behavior, which is a key to effective learning. Making a toilet paper mountain means helping clean up. Riding a bike without a helmet means that rather than simply jumping on the bike and riding, for 2 weeks there will be a required safety check anytime the bicycle comes out of the garage. Leaving a bat at baseball practice means having to borrow a teammate's bat until the other one turns up. Those are connected parental responses that are clearly linked to the behavior. They aren't punitive or retaliatory in any way. They are focused on teaching kids lessons and helping them understand about making things right. Timeouts, though, often don't relate in any clear way to a child's poor decision or out-of-control reaction. As a result, they're often not as effective in terms of changing behavior. Even when parents have good intentions, timeouts are often used inappropriately. We might want timeouts to give kids a chance to calm down and pull themselves together so they can move out of their internal chaos into calm and cooperation. But much of the time, parents use timeouts punitively, where the goal isn't to help the child return to his calm baseline or to learn an important lesson, but to punish him for some misbehavior. The calming, teaching aspect of the timeout gets totally lost. But the biggest reason we question the value of timeouts has to do with a child's profound need for connection. Often, misbehavior is a result of a child getting overtaxed emotionally, so the expression of a need or a big feeling comes out in ways that are aggressive, disrespectful, or uncooperative. She may be hungry or tired, or maybe there's some other reason she's incapable in that moment of self-control and making a good decision. Maybe the explanation is simply that she's three and her brain isn't sophisticated enough to understand and calmly express her feelings. So instead of doing her best to convey her crushing disappointment and anger that there's no grape juice left, she begins throwing toys at you. It's during these times that a child most needs our comfort and calm presence. Forcing her to go off and sit by herself can feel like abandonment to a child, especially if she's feeling out of control already. It may even send the subtle message that when she isn't doing the right thing, you don't want to be near her. You don't want to send the message that you'll be in a relationship with her when she's good or happy, but you'll withhold your love and affection when she's not. Would you want to stay in that kind of relationship? Wouldn't we suggest to our teenagers that they might think about avoiding friends or partners who treat them like that when they've made a mistake? We're not saying that short timeouts are the worst possible discipline technique, that they cause trauma, or that there's never an instance to use them. If done appropriately, with loving connection, such as sitting with the child and talking or comforting, what can be called a time in, some time to calm down can be helpful for children. In fact, teaching kids how to pause and take some inner reflection time, some time in, is essential for building executive functions that reduce impulsivity and harness the power of focused attention. But such reflection is created in relationship, not in complete isolation, especially for younger children. As children get older, they can benefit from inner reflection, from time in, to focus their attention on their inner world. This is how they learn to see the sea inside and to develop the skill to calm the storms inside. Such time in is the basis of mindsight, of seeing one's own mind and the mind of others with insight and empathy. And mindsight includes the process of integration that enables inner states to be changed, to move from chaos or rigidity to an inner state of harmony and flexibility. Mindsight, insight, empathy, and integration, is the basis of social and emotional intelligence. So using time in to develop inner reflective skills is how we help children and adolescents build the circuitry of such important abilities. No drama discipline would use a time in to stop behavior, the first goal, and to invite inner reflection that builds executive skills, our second goal. One proactive strategy that can be effective is to help the child create a calm zone with toys, books, or a favorite plush animal, which she visits when she needs the time and place to calm down. That's internal self-regulation, a fundamental skill of executive function. This is a good idea for parents, too. Maybe some chocolate, magazines, music, red wine. It's not about punishment or making a child pay for her mistake. It's about offering a choice and a place that helps the child self-regulate and down-regulate, which involves downshifting out of her emotional overload. As you'll soon see, there are dozens of other, more nurturing, relationship-building, and effective ways to respond to kids than to automatically give them a timeout as a one-size-fits-all default consequence for any misbehavior. The same goes for spanking, and even for giving consequences in general. Fortunately, as we'll soon explain, there are better alternatives than to spank, give a timeout, or automatically take away a toy or a privilege. Alternatives that are logically and naturally linked to the child's behavior, that build the brain, and that maintain a strong connection between parent and child. What is your discipline philosophy? The main point we've communicated in this chapter is that parents need to be intentional about how they respond when their kids misbehave. Rather than dramatically or emotionally reacting, or responding to every infraction with a one-size-fits-all strategy that ignores the context of the situation or a child's developmental stage, parents can work from principles and strategies that both match their belief system and respect their children as the individuals they are. No drama discipline focuses not only on addressing immediate circumstances and short-term behavior, but also on building skills and creating connections in the brain that, in the long run, will help children make thoughtful choices and handle their emotions well automatically, meaning that discipline will be needed less and less. How are you doing on this? How intentional are you when you discipline your children? Take a moment right now and think about your normal response to your kids' behavior. Do you automatically spank, give a timeout, or yell? Do you have some other immediate go-to for when your kids act out? Maybe you simply do what your parents did, or just the opposite. The real question is, how much of your disciplinary strategy comes from an intentional and consistent approach, as opposed to simply reacting or relying on old habits and default mechanisms? Here are some questions to ask yourself as you think about your overall discipline philosophy. 1. Do I have a discipline philosophy? How purposeful and consistent am I when I don't like how my kids are behaving? 2. Is what I'm doing working? Does my approach allow me to teach my kids the lessons I want to teach in terms of both immediate behavior and how they grow and develop as human beings? And am I finding that I need to address behaviors less and less, or am I having to discipline about the same behaviors over and over? 3. Do I feel good about what I'm doing? Does my discipline approach help me enjoy my relationship with my children more? Do I usually reflect on discipline moments and feel pleased with how I handled myself? Do I frequently wonder if there's a better way? 4. Do my kids feel good about it? Discipline is rarely going to be popular, but do my children understand my approach and feel my love? Am I communicating and modeling respect in a way that allows them to still feel good about themselves? 5. Do I feel good about the messages I'm communicating to my children? Are there times when I teach lessons I don't want them to internalize? For example, that obeying what I say is more important than learning to make good decisions about doing the right thing, or that power and control are the best ways to get people to do what we want, or that I only want to be around them if they're pleasant. 6. How much does my approach resemble that of my own parents? How did my parents discipline me? Can I remember a specific experience of discipline and how it made me feel? Am I just repeating old patterns, rebelling against them? 7. Does my approach ever lead to my kids apologizing in a sincere manner? Even though this might not happen on a regular basis, does my approach at least leave the door open for it? 8. Does it allow for me to take responsibility and apologize for my own actions? How open am I with my kids about the fact that I make mistakes? Am I willing to model for them what it means to own up to one's errors? How do you feel right now, having asked yourself these questions? Many parents experience regret, guilt, shame, or even hopelessness when they acknowledge what has not been working and worry that they might not have been doing the best they can. But the truth is, you have done the best you can. If you could have done better, you would have. As you learn new principles and strategies, the goal is not to berate yourself for missed opportunities, but to try to create new opportunities. When we know better, we do better. There are things we, as experts, have learned over the years that we wish we'd known or thought about when our children were babies. Our children's brains are extremely plastic. They change their structure in response to experience. And our children can respond very quickly and very productively to new experiences. The more compassion you can have for yourself, the more compassion you can have for your child. Even loving parents realize that there will always be times they can be more intentional, effective, and respectful regarding how they discipline their children. In the remaining chapters, our goal is to help you think about what you want for your kids when it comes to guiding and teaching them. None of us will ever be perfect, but we can take steps toward modeling calm and self-control when our kids mess up. We can ask the why, what, how questions. We can steer clear of one-size-fits-all disciplinary techniques. We can offer the two goals of shaping external behaviors and learning internal skills. And we can work on reducing the number of times we simply react or overreact to a situation and increasing the times we respond out of a clear and receptive sense of what we believe our kids need in each particular moment and as they move through childhood toward adolescence and adulthood.
Chapter 2, Your Brain on Discipline. Liz's morning was going along fine. Both of her kids had eaten breakfast, everyone was dressed, and she and her husband Tim were heading out the door to take their daughters to their respective schools. Then, all of a sudden, when Liz uttered the most seemingly trivial statement as she closed the front door behind her, "Nina, you get in Daddy's car, and Vera, you get in the van," everything fell apart. Tim and their 7-year-old Vera had already started toward the driveway, and Liz was locking the front door when a feral scream from just behind her made her heart stop. She quickly turned around to see Nina, her 4-year-old, standing on the bottom step of the porch screaming, "No!" in an astonishingly ear-splitting register. Liz looked at Tim, then at Vera, both of whom shrugged, eyes wide with confusion. Nina's long-sustained no had been replaced by a staccato, "No, no, no," repeated again at full volume. Liz quickly knelt and pulled Nina to her, her daughter's shrieks mercifully petering out and turning into sobs. "Honey, what is it?" Liz asked. She was dumbfounded at this outburst. "What is it?" Nina continued to cry but was able to utter, "You took Vera yesterday." Liz again looked at Tim, who had walked toward them, and offered a puzzled, "I have no idea," shrug. Liz, her ears still ringing, tried to explain. "I know, sweetheart. That's because Vera's school is right by my work." Nina pulled back from her mother and screamed, "But it's my turn!" Now that she knew her daughter wasn't in danger, Liz took a deep breath and briefly wondered what decibel level a high-pitched scream would have to reach to actually break glass. Vera, typically unsympathetic when it came to her sister's distress, impatiently announced, "Mom, I'm gonna be late." Before we describe how Liz handled this classic parenting situation, We need to introduce a few simple facts about the human brain and the way it can impact our disciplinary decisions when our kids misbehave, or, as in this case, just lose control of themselves. Let's begin with three foundational discoveries about the brain. We'll call them the three brain seeds, and that can be immensely beneficial when it comes to helping you discipline effectively and with less drama, all while teaching your children important lessons about self-control and relationships. Brain seed number one, the brain is changing. The first brain seed, that the brain is changing, sounds simple, but its implications are enormous and should inform just about everything we do with our kids, including discipline. A child's brain is like a house that's under construction. The downstairs brain is made up of the brain stem and the limbic region, which together form the lower sections of the brain, often called the reptilian brain and the old mammalian brain. These lower regions exist inside your skull from about the level of the bridge of your nose down to the top of your neck, and some of it, the brain stem, is well developed at birth. We consider this downstairs brain to be much more primitive because it's responsible for our most fundamental neural and mental operations. Strong emotions, instincts like protecting our young, and basic functions like breathing, regulating sleep and wake cycles, and digestion. The downstairs brain is what causes a toddler to throw a toy or bite someone when he doesn't get his way. It can be the source of our reactivity, and its motto is a rushed, fire, ready, aim. And often it skips the ready and aim parts altogether. It was Nina's downstairs brain that took over when she was told her mom wouldn't be driving her to school. As you well know if you're a parent, the downstairs brain, with all of its primitive functions, is alive and well in even the youngest children. The upstairs brain, though, which is responsible for more sophisticated and complex thinking, is undeveloped at birth and begins to grow during infancy and childhood. The upstairs brain is made up of the cerebral cortex, which is the outermost layer of the brain, and it resides directly behind your forehead and continues to the back of your head like a half dome covering the downstairs brain below it. Sometimes people refer to the cortex as the outer bark of the brain. Unlike the primitive downstairs brain with all of its rudimentary functions, the upstairs brain is responsible for a laundry list of thinking, emotional, and relational skills that allow us to live balanced, meaningful lives and enjoy healthy relationships, sound decision-making and planning, regulation of emotions and body, personal insight, flexibility and adaptability, empathy, morality. These are the very qualities we want to help instill in our children, and they all require a well-developed upstairs brain. The problem is that the upstairs brain takes time to develop. A long time. We're sorry to report, especially if today happens to be the third time this week that your 12-year-old left his homework binder in his locker, that the upstairs brain actually won't be fully formed until a person reaches his mid-20s. That doesn't mean there's nothing for it to do along the way. It simply means that while a child's brain is being constructed, the adolescent brain is in a period of remodeling itself and will be changing the basic upstairs brain structures that were created in the first dozen years of life. Dan explores all of this in his book for and about adolescence called Brainstorm. The great news is that knowing about the brain, for you and your child or adolescent, can change the way each of you approaches learning and behaving. When we know about the brain, we can guide our minds, how we pay attention, how we think, how we feel, how we interact with others, in ways that support solid, healthy brain development across the lifespan. Still, what this all means is that as much as we'd like for our kids to consistently behave as if they were fully developed, conscientious adults with reliably functioning logic, emotional balance, and morality, they just can't yet when they are young. At least not all the time. As a result, we have to proceed accordingly and adjust our expectations. We want to turn to our 9-year-old and ask, as we comfort our 5-year-old whose eye has been struck by a Nerf bullet fired at infuriatingly close range, "What were you thinking?" His answer, of course, will be, "I don't know," or, "I wasn't thinking." And most likely, he'll be right. His upstairs brain wasn't engaged when he aimed at his sister's pupil, just as her upstairs brain wasn't engaged yesterday when she demanded that her cousin's beach party be moved inside because she got a cut on her heel and didn't want to get sand in it. The bottom line is that no matter how smart, responsible, or conscientious your child is, it's unfair to expect her to always handle herself well or to always distinguish between a good choice and a bad one. That's even impossible for adults to do all the time. A good example of this gradual development can be found in a particular area of the upstairs brain called the right temporal parietal junction, TPJ. The right TPJ plays a special role when it comes to helping us understand what's going on in the mind of another. When we view a situation or a problem as someone else would, the right TPJ becomes active and works with areas in the prefrontal cortex just behind the forehead, essentially to allow us to empathize with another. These and other areas are part of what is called a mentalizing circuit, because they are involved in mind sight, that is, seeing the mind of others and even of ourselves. We can build mind sight in our children as we guide them toward insight, empathy, and moral thinking. Empathy, of course, affects our moral and relational lives in significant and foundational ways. We're willing to cut someone some slack if she meant well when she messed up. We're willing to give someone the benefit of the doubt if we trust his motives. A child, though, who is still developing and whose upstairs brain, which includes his right TPJ and prefrontal regions, is still under construction, will often be unable to consider motives and intention when he looks at a situation or problem. Ethical decisions will be much more black and white, and concerns about issues like justice and fairness will be much more clear-cut. Nina, for example, had no interest in discussing contextual information about how close her sister's school was to her mom's job. That logical, factual bit of data was irrelevant to her. She cared only that her sister had ridden with her mother yesterday, and fairness would dictate that Nina should get to ride with her today. So for Liz to understand her daughter's point of view, she needed to realize that Nina was viewing events through the lens of her still-growing upstairs brain, which wasn't always able to consider situational and contextual information. As we'll explain in subsequent chapters, when we use our own mind sight circuits to sense the mind behind our children's behavior, we model for them how to sense the mind within themselves and others. Mind sight is a teachable skill at the heart of being empathic and insightful, moral and compassionate. Mind sight is the basis of social and emotional intelligence, and we can model this for our children as we help guide the development of their changing brains. The point is that when we parent, and especially when we discipline, we need to work hard to understand our children's points of view, their developmental stage, and what they are ultimately capable of. This is how we use our own mind sight skills to see the mind behind our children's behavior. We don't simply react to their external actions. We tune in to the mind behind the behavior. We also must remember that what they're capable of isn't always the same. Their capacity changes when they are feeling tired, hungry, or overwhelmed. Comprehending this particular brain C, that the brain is changing and still developing, can move us to a place where we can listen to our kids with more understanding and compassion and more fully understand why it is that they're upset and having a hard time managing themselves. It is simply unfair to assume that our children are making decisions using fully formed, perfectly functioning brains and can view the world as we do. Think about the list of functions the upstairs brain is responsible for. Is that a realistic description of any child's character? Of course we'd love to see our kids demonstrate these qualities each and every moment of their lives. Who wouldn't want a child who plans ahead and consistently makes good decisions, controls his emotions and body, displays flexibility and empathy and self-understanding, and acts out of a well-developed sense of morality? But it's just not going to happen. At least, not all the time. Depending on the child and the age, maybe not even frequently. So is this an excuse for bad behavior? Do we need to simply turn a blind eye when our kids misbehave? Certainly not. In fact, a child's developing brain is simply another reason we need to set clear boundaries and help her understand what's acceptable. The fact that she doesn't have a consistently working upstairs brain, which provides internal constraints that govern her behavior, means that she needs to be provided with external constraints. And guess where those external constraints need to come from? Her parents and other caregivers, and the guidelines and expectations they communicate to her. We need to help develop our children's upstairs brain, along with all of the skills it makes possible. And while doing so, we may need to act as an external upstairs brain along the way, working with them and helping them make decisions they're not quite capable yet of making for themselves. We'll soon go into this idea in much greater depth and offer practical suggestions for making it happen. For now, though, just keep this initial brain C in mind. A child's brain is changing and developing, so we need to temper our expectations and understand that emotional and behavioral challenges are simply par for the course. Of course, we should still teach and expect respectful behavior. But in doing so, we need to always keep in mind the changing, developing brain. Once we understand and accept this fundamental reality, we'll be much more capable of responding in a way that honors the child and the relationship, while still attending to any behaviors we need to address. Brain C, number two. The brain is changeable. The second brain C is immensely exciting and offers hope to parents everywhere. The brain is not only changing, it develops over time, but changeable. It can be molded intentionally by experience. If you read much about the brain these days, you'll likely come across the concept of neuroplasticity, which refers to the way the brain physically changes based on experiences we undergo. As scientists put it, the brain is plastic, or moldable. Yes, the actual physical architecture of the brain changes based on what happens to us. You may have heard about scientific studies that demonstrate evidence of neuroplasticity. In The Whole Brain Child, we talk about research showing enlarged auditory centers in the brains of animals who depend on their hearing for hunting, and studies showing that for violinists, the regions of the cortex that represent the left hand, which fingers the instrument's strings at amazing speeds, are larger than normal. Other recent studies demonstrate that children who are taught to read music and play the keyboard undergo significant changes in their brain and have an advanced capacity for what's called spatial sensory motor mapping. In other words, when kids learn even the fundamentals of playing piano, their brains develop differently from the brains of kids who don't, so they can more fully understand their own bodies in relationship to the objects around them. We've seen similar results in studies on people who meditate. Mindfulness exercises produce literal changes in the brain's connections, significantly affecting how well a person interacts with other people and adapts to difficult situations. Obviously, this isn't to say that all children should take piano lessons or that everyone should meditate, although we wouldn't discourage either activity. The point is that the experience of taking the lessons, like the experience of participating in mindfulness practices or playing the violin or even practicing karate, fundamentally and physically changes the plastic brain, especially while it's developing in childhood and adolescence, but even throughout our lives. To take a more extreme example, Early childhood abuse can leave people vulnerable to mental illness later in life. Recent studies have used functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, or brain scans to discover specific changes in certain areas of what's called the hippocampus, in the brains of young adults who have experienced abuse. They experience higher rates of depression, addiction, and post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Their brains have fundamentally changed in response to the trauma they faced as children. Neuroplasticity has enormous ramifications for what we do as parents. If repeated experiences actually change the physical architecture of the brain, then it becomes paramount that we be intentional about the experiences we give our children. Think about the ways you interact with your kids. How do you communicate with them? How do you help them reflect on their actions and behavior? What do you teach them about relationships, about respect, trust, and effort? What opportunities do you expose them to? What important people do you introduce into their lives? Everything they see, hear, feel, touch, or even smell impacts their brain and thus influences the way they view and interact with their world, including their family, neighbors, strangers, friends, classmates, and even themselves. All of this takes place at the cellular level, in our neurons, and in the connections among our brain cells called synapses. One way neuroscientists have expressed the idea is that neurons that fire together wire together. This phrase, known as Hebb's axiom, named after the Canadian neuropsychologist Donald Hebb, essentially explains that when neurons fire simultaneously in response to an experience, those neurons become connected to each other, forming a network. And when an experience is repeated over and over, it deepens and strengthens the connections among those neurons. So when they fire together, they wire together. The famous physiologist Ivan Pavlov was coming to terms with this idea when he found that his dogs would salivate not only when actual food appeared before them, but also when he rang the dinner bell for them to come eat. The dogs' salivation neurons became wired or functionally linked to their dinner bell neurons. A more recent example from the animal world appears every time the San Francisco Giants play a night game at AT&T Park. Near the end of each game, swarms of seagulls appear, ready for a feast of left-behind hot dogs, peanuts, and Cracker Jack once the Bayside Stadium empties. Biologists are stumped as to how exactly the birds time their arrival for the ninth inning. Is it the increased noise of the crowd, the lure of the stadium lights, the organ playing Take Me Out to the Ballgame during the seventh inning stretch? One thing seems clear, though. The birds have been conditioned or primed to expect food once the game ends. Neurons have fired together and subsequently been wired together. Hebb's axiom is what causes a toddler to raise his hands and say, "Hold you?" when he wants to be picked up. He hardly understands the meaning of the exact words and obviously hasn't quite figured out his pronouns. But he knows that when he's been asked, "Do you want me to hold you?" he's been picked up. So when he wants to be held, he asks, "Hold you?" Firing and wiring. Having neurons wired together can be a good thing. A positive experience with a math teacher can lead to neural connections that link math with pleasure, accomplishment, and feeling good about yourself as a student. But the opposite is equally true. Negative experiences with a harsh instructor or a timed test and the anxiety that accompanies it can form connections in the brain that create a serious obstacle to the enjoyment not only of math and numbers, but exams and even school in general. The point is simple but crucial to understand. Experiences lead to changes in the architecture of the brain. Practically, then, we want to keep neuroplasticity in mind when we make decisions about how we interact with kids and how they spend their time. We want to consider what neural connections are being formed and how they will play out in the future. For example, what movies do you want your kids to see, and what activities do you want them to spend hours of time enjoying? knowing that the plastic brain will be altered with experience, we might be less comfortable with hours spent watching certain television programs or playing violent video games. We might instead encourage our kids to engage in activities that build their capacity for relationships and for understanding other people, whether that means hanging out with friends, playing games with their family, or participating in sports and other group activities that ask them to work with others as a team. We might even purposely create time for boredom on a summer day, so they have to go to the garage and see what interesting fun they can have with a pulley, some rope, and a roll of duct tape. If someone comes back inside to Google the phrase, duct tape parachute for baby brother, you might want to break out the Monopoly board. We cannot, nor would we want to, protect or rescue our kids from all adversity and negative experiences. These challenging experiences are an important part of growing up and developing resilience, along with acquiring internal skills needed to cope with stress and failure, and to respond with flexibility. What we can do is help our children make sense of their experiences so that those challenges will more likely be encoded in the brain consciously as learning experiences, rather than unconscious associations or even traumas that limit them in the future. When parents discuss experiences and memories with their kids, the children tend to have better access to memories of those experiences. Kids whose parents talk to them about their feelings also develop a more robust emotional intelligence and can therefore be better at noticing and understanding their own and other people's feelings. Neurons that fire together wire together, changing the changeable brain. It all comes back to the point that the brain changes in response to experience. What do you want your children to experience that will affect their changeable brains? What brain connections do you want to nurture? And more to the point in this book, knowing that a child's brain is changeable, how do you want to respond to misbehavior? After all, your kids' repeated experiences with discipline will be wiring their brains as well. Brain C number 3. The brain is complex. So the brain is changing and changeable. It's also complex, which is our third brain C. The brain is multifaceted with different parts responsible for different tasks. Some parts are responsible for memory, others for language, others for empathy, and so on. This third brain C is one of the most important realities to keep in mind when it comes to discipline. The brain's complexity means that when our kids are upset, or when they're acting in ways we don't like, we can appeal to different parts of their brains, to different regions and ways the brain functions, with different parental responses activating different circuitry. We can therefore appeal to one part of the brain to get one result, another part to get a different result. For example, let's go back to the upstairs and downstairs brains. If your child is melting down and out of control, which part of the brain would you rather appeal to? The one that's primitive and reactive? Or the one that's sophisticated and capable of logic, compassion, and self-understanding? Do we try to connect to the one that responds as a reptile would, with defensiveness and attacks? Or to the one with the potential to calm down, problem solve, and even apologize? The answer is obvious. We want to engage the upstairs brain's receptivity, rather than trigger the downstairs brain's reactivity. Then, the higher parts of the brain can communicate and help override the lower, more impulsive and reactive parts. When we discipline with threats, whether explicitly through our words or implicitly through scary nonverbals like our tone, posture, and facial expressions, we activate the defensive circuits of our child's reactive reptilian downstairs brain. We call this poking the lizard, and we don't recommend it because it almost always leads to escalating emotions for both parent and child. When your 5-year-old throws a fit at the grocery store, and you tower over him and point your finger and insist through clenched teeth that he calm down this instant, you're poking the lizard. you're triggering a downstairs reaction, which is almost never going to lead anywhere productive for anyone involved. Your child's sensory system takes in your body language and words.